right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a packed show for you today. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with journalist Lee Onesto. Lee is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and she's going to talk with us about the recent earthquake in Nepal, all right? The human suffering and the very inhuman forces that have made it even worse. Before that, we'll be talking with Dina Seidel, the director of the film Antarctic Edge. Don't want to miss this one. It's a very compelling film about what the hell is happening to the Earth, all right? So stay tuned for that. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be talking with Lynn Washington. Lynn is a Philadelphia-based investigative journalist and a columnist for the Philadelphia Tribune. He's also a founder of the This Can't Be Happening News website and a contributor to Hopeless, Barack Obama, and the Politics of Illusion. And we're going to be talking with Lynn about Mumia Abu-Jamal and what Lynn has called the very public execution of Mumia Abu-Jamal that's going on right now, even as we speak. Before we get into that, though, I want to give people a sense of the history of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who he is and how he ended up doing life without parole in a Pennsylvania prison. Mumia Abu-Jamal, one of the most well-known political prisoners in the U.S., has been unjustly imprisoned in Pennsylvania for nearly 35 years. A well-known revolutionary journalist and former Black Panther, he was tried, convicted, and given the death penalty for the murder of a cop in a trial that was a complete travesty of justice. He was denied the right to serve as his own attorney, barred from the courtroom for half the trial with an overwhelmingly white jury. The prosecution claimed Mumia had confessed, which was a lie. Mumia spent a quarter of a century in solitary confinement on death row until courts overturned his death sentence while affirming his conviction, leaving him to face the prospect of life in prison without parole. There has been an international movement to free Mumia, and throughout all of this, Mumia has continued to denounce the crimes against humanity perpetrated by this system in both audio and written commentaries. And I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Lynn Washington Jr. And Lynn has been covering the situation with Mumia Abu-Jamal since 1981. Lynn, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Sure. You recently wrote an article, which I think, you know, just to jump right into the heart of it, you recently wrote an article in which you said that although public executions have been long banned in this country, this is, in fact, what's being done to Mumia today. Explain that.
Well, currently, Mumia Abu-Jamal, who's serving a life sentence in a prison in Pennsylvania after his death sentence was voided, he's extraordinarily sick, some very debilitating illnesses, diabetes, a uncontrolled skin rash, high blood pressure, possibly cancer. And the problem has been this. Mumia has not received adequate care inside the prison. Now, in many ways and in every way, this is reflective of the poor quality care that prisoners get in Pennsylvania. So the circumstance is this. Abu-Jamal had been treated for this skin rash that he has. It's all over his body, and it's causing him an intense pain on the skin in terms of itching and internal burning. During that treatment, he was given multiple blood tests, but none of these blood tests either picked up or he was informed that they found diabetes. And as a result of that, Abu-Jamal was rushed from the prison at the end of March nearly in a diabetic coma. Since then, he's been receiving the same level of poor care, and it gives the appearance, and I think with some justification, that this lack, or should we say insufficient medical care, is not just a consequence of negligence, but it's a deliberate act to withhold care to effectuate his death, which in turn becomes a public execution.
You know, let's walk through a little bit more of this, because it's like you say, you know, when I read your piece and I was thinking about it, it really is insane that something that's as easy to detect as diabetes, something that's as easy to treat as diabetes, is actually something that can be taking Mumia right to the brink of a diabetic coma, which is also can very easily become fatal. Let's talk about that, because this is part of this thing of this whole, on one level, they're sort of doing a public execution. On the other hand, they're sitting back and saying, what? We're taking care of him.
Well, to put this public execution in a little context, it may seem like a big leap to say, well, he's receiving negligent medical care, and thus he is now being subjected to a slow death through the withholding of this medical care, and this being done in such a public way in that people are trying to raise attention about his condition that it becomes a public execution. What has happened with Abu-Jamal from the time of his arrest on December 9th, 1981, has been extraordinary. When he was arrested that night, or early that morning, the incident took place at 4 a.m. in the morning, where he was arrested for shooting a police officer. He was beaten at the crime scene, and officers testified that, no, they didn't beat him, but they inadvertently ran his head into a telephone pole 7 times as they tried to take him from the crime scene, where he was critically wounded by the policeman, and take him to a van about 10 yards away. And in this process of taking him to the van, where his head was inadvertently rammed into a pole, he was dropped a couple of times. While inside the van, he was beaten. Inside the hospital emergency room, he was beaten. And then after he emerged from emergency surgery, he was beaten again. And so throughout his time on death row, he has been subjected to some extraordinary mistreatments. So what is happening now with the poor care that he is receiving raises a legitimate question as to whether this is just the normal poor care, the normal negligence that all prisoners receive, or if this is a yet another effort to try to kill Mumia, to effectuate the execution that many in the police community and many in the political community in Pennsylvania feel was a thwarted execution when the federal courts found that there were constitutional violations in the way he was sentenced to death.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I found very interesting in the piece that you wrote on this, and the many pieces actually you've written on this since over the last 2 months or so, a month and a half, and you know, around this specific thing of Mumia's mistreatment and the neglect of his health care in prison, you made a point that Mumia has not even been allowed to consult with his own doctors. He's not been allowed to do any outside kind of consultation that would have any meaning and could actually help to have determined and to, including getting out the word to, and this maybe this is why he's not been allowed to do it, could get out the word about what's happening there and pinpointing what is being done, what isn't being done. Is this a fairly common thing that prisoners are not allowed to consult with their own doctors?
Well, what is fairly common is that prisoners in Pennsylvania and unfortunately prisoners across the United States are not given adequate care. And this has been compounded by the fact that many prison systems have been privatizing their medical care. Thus, these private entities that are really for-profit entities, they only make more money when the cost of the service that they provide is lessened. So that means reduced care. Now, on one level, people will say, well, wait a minute, what are you saying? It's a prisoner should have access to the doctor that he wants. He's a prisoner. Or she's a prisoner, so they don't have those kind of rights. But there has been precedent in Pennsylvania where a prisoner has been able to pay for their care by their own private doctor. There was a prisoner named John DuPont, a multimillionaire, seeking to an extraordinary fortune out of Delaware, the DuPont fortune. And he, John DuPont, was convicted of murdering a guy. It actually was even turned into a movie where, John DuPont was a supporter of the U.S. Olympic wrestling team, and he killed one of the members of that team that was practicing at a special facility that he had on his estate. So there is precedent that if an inmate can pay for medical care, that he should receive that care. So what people are asking for Abu-Jamal, saying, look, you have not given him the care within the prison system. When you took him to the emergency room, nearly on the verge of death, you took him to a facility that did not have adequate treatment for diabetes and related things to that. So you're blocking efforts to either provide Abu-Jamal the level of care that he needs or allow him to have access to the caliber of care that he needs at his own expense, raises questions about your duty to provide adequate medical care to prisoners. So I guess the bottom line is what I'm saying is there's precedent that if a prisoner can afford to pay for their own care, they received it. In this instance, Abu-Jamal is not receiving it, and this fits right back into a series, I mean a long series of instances where Abu-Jamal has been denied privileges and rights that other prisoners have received. So it's not like we're trying to give this guy special treatment. Simply, his supporters are asking that he receive the same access to treatment that others have received.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Lynn Washington, Jr. Lynn is a Philadelphia-based investigative journalist and a columnist for the Philadelphia Tribune. He's also a founder of the This Can't Be Happening news website and a contributor to Hopeless, Barack Obama, and the Politics of Illusion. And Lynn has been writing about Mumia Abu-Jamal since 1981, when Mumia was first attacked and framed and convicted and given a death sentence back then. And he's been fighting all along for justice, and it continues today. Now, Lynn, one of the things that you were just saying about this sort of the rights, you know, the rights of a prisoner, it's sort of, it seems really this question of, as hard as it may seem to believe in the U.S. today, it doesn't seem that, like, automatically going to prison also entails automatically being denied your humanity, you know, although it ends up being forced that way. And that seems to be very much what's happening here with Mumia, in my mind. It's sort of, even the thing that you're just referring to and getting to, the idea that even after he went to the hospital, after he was finally taken to a hospital, and he's kept there for a little while, and then he's immediately returned to the prison, and it's basically, he was returned like as if to just throw him into his cell and say, you know, and yeah, they gave him a sort of nominal stay in the prison infirmary and whatnot, but then they throw him back in his cell and just leave him there. This is a fairly blatant expression of you're not human, and damn it, we just wish you'd die and go away.
I think your characterization is accurate. Abu-Jamal was taken to the hospital with extraordinarily elevated levels of blood sugar and sodium. So these are conditions that you don't just give somebody a Band-Aid in an Alka-Seltzer and say, you're okay, come, go back, and if you have any problems, come on back and see me. When he was returned after, I think, 3 days in the intensive care unit of the hospital, he was in the infirmary for about 2 days inside the prison. Then he was sent back to his cell. He could hardly walk. He was very weak. He should have been allowed to stay in the prison infirmary, albeit the same infirmary that gave him the poor treatment that resulted in him going to the hospital. So if he's in his cell and he's the distance of about three city blocks from the infirmary, how is he supposed to walk back? If he's too weak to get out of bed, how can he go to receive the medications and other treatment? How could he even get to the dining room? And then when his sickness prevents him from getting up doing those things, then he's given prison infractions for not following the rules. You're too sick to walk to the dining hall, and you know you just can't physically walk there, but because you can't walk there, and we know you can't walk there, we're going to give you a disciplinary report for your failure to walk to the dining room. So it would seem to be very malicious what's going on inside the prisons. And in America, despite the veneer of humanity and respecting the rights of people, we do an extraordinarily and a deliberately poor job with prisoners. But we have to also understand that in the Constitution of the United States, slavery and slavery-like conditions are legally permissible in prison. The 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that outlaws slavery says that slavery is outlawed except for persons who have been convicted of a crime. So we do a bad job, but we also are the country that proclaims that it's the freest country in the world, but we incarcerate more people than any other country on earth, including China and North Korea and a lot of the countries that we like to criticize. The type of sentences that our prisoners receive are seen as appalling in Europe, which we always consider ourselves as our peer type nations. To have a prison of a sentence of 30 years in a country like Germany or France or is just People just don't understand that. Murderers don't get that type of time. However, unfortunately, the American mentality, the American penal mentality, is now permeating many European countries. So you have in, say, England, the United Kingdom, a explosion of life with life sentences, and they're trying to put in life without parole. But at the same time, governmental bodies and continent-wide bodies there in Europe are creating a law that says that it is cruel and unusual punishment to put somebody in jail for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're running up on our time, but I do have a couple of other questions. And one of them is, you know, I keep thinking about the vengeance sought in this situation, in Mumia's case. You know, from the very beginning, the fact that there was this, you know, this whatever happened at that night, and Mumia ended up shot, severely wounded, the cop ended up dead. All of this, you know, this sort of pounding at this is the guy we're going to go for. And this is a man who, I mean, look, when they knew, I mean, I knew, I was telling you earlier, I grew up in Philly. I knew who Mumia was, you know, and people, he was a Panther who actually, you know, at the time when he was a young kid, he became a Black Panther, and he was very outspoken. He was in charge of their press in that area. And he was somebody who never shied away from calling out the system and calling on people to stand up against it. And the vengeance sought for somebody who's doing that seems to be carrying its way through the trial, the incredibly racist judge, all the machinations that went on in terms of trying to, you know, the railroad they carried out. And then it continues. It continued all the way through the insistence they're going to kill him. And then when it's finally turned around, what's he get? He gets life in prison without parole, which is another way of killing him.
You're correct that there has always been a particular targeting of Mumia. But I think that one thing that needs to be highlighted is that persons in Philadelphia, regardless of your prominence, and Mumia had prominence at the time of his arrest and false incarceration, people are mistreated horribly by Philadelphia's justice system, and that includes police, prosecutors, and judges. For some reason, what happened with Abu Jamal was highlighted by the authorities, in part because of that Black Panther connection. But there were three police officers killed in 1981. You only hear about one of them. That's Officer Daniel Faulkner. Two others were killed, one on duty and one off duty. But the person who killed the off-duty officer knew he was an officer and targeted him despite that. The person who killed the off-duty officer serving life in prison, nobody knows his name or even the name of the officer he killed. And then the other police officer who was slain on duty, it was a sniper attack. They arrested someone. The guy had a good lawyer. There was a fair trial. The man was acquitted. One thing that I find very curious about these three officers, you hear about one, that was the officer who was white. The other two officers are Black, and you hear nothing about them, even from the police union.
Wow. Let me ask you this. That gets us right to this question, and this will have to be our final question. As much as I enjoy talking with you, man, we're going to have you back on regularly, I think.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you know, you've made the point that what's being done to Mumia now is very much connected to the state violence that we see in Baltimore, New York, Ferguson, Philadelphia, L.A., et cetera. Let's talk about that.
Well, one of the problems that underlie what you see going on in Ferguson or New York City or now Baltimore is what is called a double standard of justice, where one group gets penalized harshly while another group gets, let's just say, benefit of the doubts, laws being bent or broken. Say in Maryland, there is a history in Baltimore of police brutality. I mean, I wrote a piece actually yesterday where I tracked some police brutality going as far back as 1946, where there were clear instances of misconduct and the authorities didn't do anything about it. So the Abu Jamal case is, shall we say, impacted with a whole series of structural injustices, and those injustices we see played out in so many instances. Let's look at Cleveland, where this young man, a 12-year-old, was shot and killed by a police officer. I mean, is that police officer under arrest now? No, it's still under investigation. Who, civilians who shoot each other, persons are arrested, charged, and on their way to trial within 24 hours. Six police officers are indicted in Baltimore for what was clearly a conduct that went against not only policy, but just basic humanity. And the police union statement was that there was a rush to judgment. We need more time to investigate. After 3 weeks, you need more time? That's far less time than you give for anybody else who's arrested for murder.
All right, Lynn Washington, we're going to have to wrap it up here, but I really look forward to talking to you again, man.
Okay, sir. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Lynn.
I appreciate being on your show.
All right, take care now. Talk to you again.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Lynn Washington, Jr. Lynn is a Philadelphia-based investigative journalist and a columnist for the Philadelphia Tribune. He's also a founder of the This Can't Be Happening news website and a contributor to Hopeless, Barack Obama, and the Politics of Illusion. And Lynn has been covering the Mumia Abu-Jamal case, his political persecution, since 1981 when it first began. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back to talk with director Dina Seidel about her new film, Antarctic Edge, so stay tuned.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be now. No. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Whoa, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be now. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas. Fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me.
All right, welcome back. That was Marvin Gaye with Mercy, Mercy Me, Ecology. I'm very, very happy to be welcoming to the show Dina Seidel. Dina is, she's the director of a film called The Antarctic Edge, 70 Degrees South. It's a thrilling journey to the bottom of the Earth alongside a team of dedicated scientists in the wake of devastating climate events like Superstorm Sandy and Hurricane Katrina. Oceanographer Oscar Schofield teams up with a group of world-class researchers in a race to understand climate change in the fastest winter warming place on Earth. Check that. The fastest winter warming place on Earth, the West Antarctic Peninsula. For more than 20 years, these scientists have dedicated their lives to studying the peninsula's rapid change as part of the National Science Foundation's long-term ecological research project. And this film is the story of one of their trips, and it blows your mind. All right, so check this out. I'm very pleased, as I said, to be welcoming Dina Seidel. Dina, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. You made a film like that is, powerful. It's about a place that very few people know much at all about. And something I'll talk with you about a little bit later is also a place that very few people ever even seen filmed pictures of. This is one of these places that very few people ever get to see. And you made a film that told a story that was about that place, about what's happening, but so much bigger. So let's talk about this. What drove you to make this film?
So what drove me to make this film is I got to know Oscar Schofield, and he's this oceanographer here at Rutgers. I happen to also direct the film program at Rutgers University, and I've been able to connect my students and narrative filmmaking to like amazing research stories. So Oscar is a really dynamic, smart scientist, but he was studying climate change with a group in Antarctica, and he and I worked together to get support from the National Science Foundation for me to direct a film on his research vessel. And why that was important is access, right? Because nobody had ever been allowed on that ship with cameras to make a documentary. They've been doing it, it's been 24 years now, and it's hard science, it's complicated, it's a very dangerous environment, it's a very intense experience, and I needed to gain their trust. And so I got the trust through Oscar, and then I was able to get the funding from the National Science Foundation, which gave me the platform to be able to follow all the scientists on that ship. And why that's important is they're looking at the changing ecosystem. And so you have scientists that are all different types of scientists, some that are studying whales, some that are studying, the small ocean animals, some that are studying the ocean plants, some that are studying the penguins, and they got to pull it all together. right? But what I wanted to do and what I pitched and what I feel we were able to do is really get a story of the people and their passion for this, what's at stake, what the physical challenges are, what the bigger global challenges are, right? Like, why do we need to understand this rapid change that's happening along the West Antarctic Peninsula, and how is it connected to our larger global system? Why should we here in America, in L.A. or New York, why should we care about, you know, rapid ice sheets melting in Antarctica, or the fact that the West Antarctic Peninsula has increased in temperature by 11 degrees Fahrenheit in the last 50 years, six times faster than the global rate of warming? Well, you know what? We're part of a large global climate system, and it's all connected. And how do we wind up understanding it? It's the day-to-day work of these really passionate, driven, brave, risk-taking, funny human scientists who all work together and go down every year and spend 2 months doing this research, collecting all this data, and then putting it into a bigger model that's really helping us understand how that ecosystem is changing and how that speaks to change that we'll see in other parts of the world as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me something, because you were mentioning this, and it's something that, you know, in the beginning of your film, it says the melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet is unstoppable. And that's a fairly solid conclusion right now.
Well, that's what scientists had declared in 2014. Mm-hmm. Yes, there was enough evidence that the melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet is happening so fast that it's not going to reverse. You know, and of course, when ice sheets melt, that raises sea level. But our story is looking a lot at the decline in sea ice, which doesn't affect sea level rise, but it does dramatically affect the ecosystem, because there's a penguin population around the Palmer Research Station, which is a U.S.-funded National Science Foundation field station that can only hold at the maximum 50 people. It's like a little tin box in the middle of nowhere. But the penguin populations around there, particularly the Adélie penguin population, has declined by 90%. And it's well thought that in 5 years that penguin population will be extinct, because the sea ice in that area has declined so much, meaning that there's sea ice 3 months less. There's 90 days less of sea ice, and these birds are dependent on sea ice, and the food that the krill that they eat is also dependent on, they're like little shrimp, that are dependent and connected to the sea ice ecosystem. So all those shifts in the ecosystem are affecting the populations. So yes, you're talking about the West Antarctic ice sheet. That's changing. It's part of just so many things that are changing really quickly. And I was only there for 6 weeks, but I saw the change. I mean, we go to the first penguin colony when we get there, and it's 40 degrees, and the penguins are panting. And, you know, the scientists are there to measure them and study them and count them. But it didn't feel like this population was well. It clearly seemed like it was too warm for these animals.
You know, one of the points that you keep making in relation to the penguins, and it's something I was really moved by, because, one, I just have to say it, those little baby penguins, they're so damn cute. It's like, I mean, they really are, you know. And you're looking at this thing, though, and you're looking at the whole population, and you're thinking, okay, so what is it about this? What, you know, you want people to understand, what difference does it make if these penguins survive or don't survive? You know, because it can be extrapolated out into many other factors, but you actually spend a lot of time focusing on them, and it gives people a sense, I think, of there's real consequences to this. Can we talk about that a little?
Sure, right. So our story is a journey, right? And it's the journey that this research vessel takes every year. And it's going down the West Antarctic Peninsula, and it starts first at Humble Island, which is a penguin colony near Palmer Station. Then it goes to a second. Several weeks later, we go to Avian Island, where the researchers, the scientists, camp out for 5 days and count all the penguins. And at the end of the film, they're trying to make it to Charcot Island, but there's a lot of sea ice there. But as they're going down the peninsula, they're saying that they're going back in time, meaning that it gets colder. And as it's getting colder, they're coming to an ecosystem or an environment that feels more similar to what Antarctica used to be, right? Because when we're in the northern peninsula, it's gotten so much warmer. And why penguins? Well, the truth is, the scientists, as I was saying, are looking at all different aspects of the ecosystem. And this sampling is hard. It's, you know, the research vessel is dangerous, and you have to get on little, you know, Zodiac boats to either measure the whales or go and do other samples. It's just hard research to do. But the penguins, we know that the larger public can understand the penguins, and really the penguins are kind of their greatest indicator of change, because you can see the decline in those populations so rapidly. So they kind of are like the canary in the coal mine. The penguins become, over these 24 years, the greatest indicator of climate change for the science group. So, again, we're at Humboldt Island and by the Palmer Station, and 85 to 90% fewer penguins existing in that area. A whole small islands of penguin colonies have just declined or disappeared entirely in the last 30 years since they started studying them. They go to Avian Island, and you're starting to see change. You see in the film that even though it's farther south and it's colder, it's starting to snow there, and that indicates precipitation. It's warm enough so that there's enough humidity in the air for there to be snow, and that also is an indication that the weather is changing. As you get farther, they're really trying to get to this very difficult island called Charco Island that is just like a super hard to get to rock precipice, it's very, very difficult to get there with these small Zodiac boats. But they want to get there and count the penguins there, because that's the closest they'll be able to get. That colony represents an environment that was true for Antarctica 30 or 40 or 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I have to tell people, well, first let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dina Seidel, and we're talking about her film, Antarctic Edge, 70 Degrees South. And it's a very compelling film, just the photography alone will blow your mind. It's and this film opens up May 15th at Lemley Music Hall here in L.A., and you shouldn't miss it. It's really an incredibly, incredibly fascinating film. It's just amazing. I have to say, there's something that's actually, you know, when we're talking and when I'm thinking back about, I watched the film a couple of times, and it's really true. The sight of all of these, the ice sheets melting, the ice dropping off, all of this stuff. And again, like I was kind of half joking about the penguins, but it really was something that struck your heart when you saw that. And part of it is these guys have been doing this. These scientists, these men and women have been doing this for 20 years. And as you were saying, it's the first time that they've ever allowed anybody to come down and film this. Why was that? It seems like it could make a really important difference if people could know what was going on and if they had known 20 years earlier. I'm just curious about this.
So I guess I can't speak to why it hasn't been done before. What I can say is there's probably a few reasons. One, the space on those research vessels is so expensive. Like the ship itself costs more than $50,000 a day to operate before the science. And so getting space on that ship, everybody who's on that ship is doing research. And so in order to get me, the camera crew was me, the documentary crew was me as the director and one of the cinematographers and sound recordist, and then Chris Linder, who's an ice photographer and also a scientist. And together we shot more than 400 hours of footage that I then brought back to my film center and involved my staff and my undergraduate documentary students in the making, because that wound up becoming an educational model of connecting art students to science learning through filmmaking. So part of it, I think, why is it now? One is that the cameras are much smaller, right? You've got digital cameras. We can do a lot more with smaller equipment, right? Even though I did have to bring a lot of equipment on the ship, it was much different than 20 years ago when you'd have been shooting in 16 millimeter and it would have been virtually impossible, certainly to get the kind of coverage that we got. I think the other thing is that Oscar Schofield and I had worked on another feature film here at Rutgers called Atlantic Crossing about his team navigating an autonomous robot across the Atlantic Ocean that did quite well, and I did it with my students. And from that, we developed a really, really trusting relationship that we could go to the National Science Foundation and say, we'd like to make a story about the long-term ecological research project, which is the feature science group of this film. And we want to, because the science is so important, it's critical, the change is so happening so fast, but guess what? We're also going to use it as the basis for an innovative, educational, interdisciplinary film production model, which I was able to do. And since starting that film, I was able to create actually the proposal for Rutgers' first film production program, and we'll be accepting our first majors in the fall. So this is cool. In the beginning, when you were talking about how do you inspire the public to make change, what I found is, you know, what we've done is we've got all these young people of diverse cultural, racial, ethnic backgrounds, economic backgrounds, really getting excited about science and feeling comfortable with science because they're having these ongoing relationships with the scientists in the films that they're making. And that makes them become the next communicators of narrative, climate-based stories. And so that there's something really beautiful about that as well. So why now? Why? Because it was the trusting relationship with Oscar. Then I got a grant. We got the grant that allowed me to give access to all the scientists on the ship. They all had to work with me, as tired as they were. And they were so tired. You know, they don't always want to stop and talk to a filmmaker and the film team and let us see their process. But we all became very good friends, and all the scientists got to approve their science content, and then they got to meet with the students, and the students loved them. And it was really, like, the process was really quite dynamic, exciting, educational, not just in the product, but in the process. Mm-hmm. We involved 14 undergraduates who are all really jazzed and trained now in science documentary filmmaking.
That's great. And then we have time for one more question in about 2.5-3 minutes. And I want to ask you this really quick. The heart of your story, you've been hitting at some pieces of it, but I want to ask you the heart of your story and why it's so damn important to science, to people, and to the planet.
The heart of the story is that climate change is now, that we have to pay attention to this now, that it affects all of us. And understanding how hard it is to collect enough data to be able to see how our planet is changing requires dedicated people that are not unlike us. We can relate to these scientists. We need to support the science. We need to know that climate change affects all of us. It affects the food system. It's going to affect our future. And it's also driven by the oceans. I think ocean awareness was really, really an important thing to learn, that, you know, the oceans are absorbing all this sun's heat. But this is a journey. This is a really exciting, dynamic, and thrilling journey in which you really will learn what it takes to work as a team and gather the science and that allows us to understand how our planet is changing, how we can all be part of making proper choices in the future, in our own lives, and how we can support research and know that science is dramatic and it's a story and it's character-driven. And we should all be invested in the future of our planet.
All right, Dina Seidel, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right, Bye. Talk to you again soon. Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dina Seidel, the director of the film Antarctic Edge, 70 Degrees South. And Dina is actually, she's an award-winning documentary filmmaker. She's a published short story author, as well as the creator and designer of the first film major at Rutgers University. And she's the director of the Rutgers Film Bureau and the Rutgers Center for Digital Filmmaking. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Lee Ernesto, a journalist for Revolution Newspaper, talking with us about the earthquake in Nepal. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Ginger Baker with Brain Damage, and that's exactly what I feel like every time I think about what this imperialist system is doing to the entire planet, including when it seems, oh, it was just an earthquake. Really? Think about what it means to be suffering in an earthquake in a world dominated by imperialism. It has now been over a week since a powerful earthquake hit Nepal on April 25th. The ground shook violently and shifted, and within minutes in the capital of Kathmandu, a densely populated city of 1.2 million people, buildings were reduced to rubble. In the rural areas where most of the people live, whole villages were flattened. An estimated 8 million people were affected by the quake in 39 of Nepal's 75 districts. My guest, Lee Ernesto, is a journalist with Revolution Newspaper. She covers many subjects, and back in the 1990s, she was in Nepal for a number of months, and she's the author of Dispatches from the People's War in Nepal. Lee, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Glad to be here.
Let's jump right into this. You were, as I said, you were there. You have a knowledge of Nepal that a lot of other people, including what seems to be in this situation with the bourgeois press in general, the idea of what actually was going on there. Let's talk about the scope of the quake that just happened and the damage done. Let's just start with that.
Well, first of all, as of May 3rd, and in the last couple of days, the death toll that's being reported now is over 7,000 people and about 14,000 people injured. And these are the news sources that are coming out of the news reports in Nepal themselves. And, I don't know if people know very much about Nepal, but it's a very, very poor country, and more than 80% of Nepal's over 29 million people live in the countryside. And, initially when people were seeing what was happening in the earthquake, most of the news reports were coming from Kathmandu, the capital city. You know, so you saw the rubble, you saw them trying to, rescue people. And it was terrible, like thousands of people had died, right? But in the countryside, where the majority, like more than 80% of the people live, whole villages were flattened. And the United Nations has now estimated that as many as 600,000 houses have been destroyed in 13 districts. And, it's a very, very dire situation. You have some 44.2 million people who are now in urgent need of water, sanitation, and food assistance. And, there's a real threat of disease and cholera. One of the things is that having traveled in Nepal into some of these rural areas, it's really hard for people here in the United States to imagine what it's like. I mean, the roads themselves, a lot of them are only accessible by foot. It's not like you can drive a car or even take a horse or a donkey. You have to travel by foot. And then you put on top of that an earthquake with landslides. And so a lot of these villages that were remote to begin with, people can't even get in there to rescue them. So the only way at this point for a lot of these places was to get them relief supplies by airlift, helicopter. And not that much of that has actually happened. Some of it has happened. But a lot of these villages are just, basically stranded.
Well, tell me this, because, one of the things that I keep thinking about, and having lived through an earthquake in Los Angeles and then a smaller quakes, and actually they were supposedly bigger, but in Mexico a number of years ago, I was out in a rural area in Mexico, and it didn't seem to me like it was anywhere near as life-threatening as what happened in Los Angeles in the middle of a big city when an earthquake hit in the middle of the night. And I'm kind of curious about this because a lot of people will think, well, look, basically, if you're in a big city, it makes sense that a lot of people are going to get hurt or going to die or going to be wounded, all this other stuff, because buildings are going to be collapsing and all this. What is it that you make the point in your article that actually this, and you're making it right now, that actually the situation as a result of the quake in the rural areas in terms of immediate death, but then also in the aftermath of all that, is much greater than it is in the urban area?
Yeah, well, it's both greater in the urban areas and in the rural areas in a poor, oppressed country like this. I mean, in my article, I quote this one seismologist, David Wald, who points out that the same size earthquake can have very different effects in different places because of the building construction, the population, and the very conditions there. For example, he says that in California, the same level of severe shaking would cause 10 to 30 people to die per million. But in Nepal, it would be an estimate would be maybe 1,000 or more. And in other parts of the country, of the world, like in Pakistan, India, Iran, it might be as much as 10,000 people. So you can see that it has to do with the very conditions that people live in. You can't really do anything about, preventing an earthquake from coming. But what happens when that earthquake comes has a lot to do with the conditions that people live in. Mm-hmm. And Nepal, it's very important for people to understand, that Nepal is very, very, is one of the poorest countries in the world and has a long been oppressed and subordinate to and dependent on and dominated by India, that's right to the south, and imperialist countries like the United States. And so you have a situation where, the vast majority of people in Nepal are peasants in the countryside that are desperately poor and malnourished and exploited. I mean, when you travel in the countryside, it's very, very primitive. You have very primitive structures, mud and thatch houses, two-story mud and thatch houses. And I can, I was just imagining, I don't know if people have seen in the news the pictures of these villages. Some of the villages are small, but you have some villages where maybe, you might have like 1,000 people living, but it's completely flattened. I mean, literally, every structure is just flattened, you know. And then you have a situation where you have very, very poor conditions to begin with. So the survivors, in terms of those people who survive an earthquake, their ability to even, you know, take care of the wounded or for the wounded to survive and live or to be able to deal with disease and destruction and all this is magnified, you know, because people to begin with didn't have access to health care or safe drinking water and sanitation. So then when you have an earthquake like this, the problems are immensely compounded.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine.
I'd also just say that that's in the roars, but in the cities, it's also the case. Like you know, I understand that actually even since I've been there, that the city has actually grown and become much more crowded because of people coming into the cities out of the rural areas because of poverty, looking for jobs, and you know, so that you have. You know, there's a lot lack of modern infrastructure. Like, I mean, when I was there, it was like every day there would be a blackout. I mean, it was a planned blackout because the whole electrical system is just, you know, it's just so primitive. I mean, you would have to go for hours without any electricity. And so over the past decade, the migration of people from the rural areas to the cities has exerted all kinds of pressure on the cities, which were already had underdeveloped infrastructure and services. So the urban poor also face homelessness, lack of clean drinking water, and poor sanitation. I mean, when I was reading about this, I did a little bit of research, and I read an article that said in Nepal there are 4 million squatters living in the city and towns, and 50,000 in Kathmandu living in settlements in very unhygienic and unsanitary areas. Hmm. So, I mean, this is the kind of the ground upon which this earthquake hit.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Lee Ernesto, a journalist from Revolution Newspaper and the author of Dispatches from the People's War in Nepal. And we're talking about Lee's recent articles in Revolution Newspaper on the earthquake in Nepal. You know, one of the things that reminds me of when you're talking about this, and I can't remember whether I read it in your article or somewhere else, the point about the interaction between the rural areas and the cities, and I would imagine a place like Kathmandu also depends very much on the rural areas for its food supplies to a certain extent, right?
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that because actually one of the things that is kind of a scar in Nepal is it's very, very dependent on India for, I mean, a huge amount of its goods, including food, I think, but also like fuel and things like this come from India. And I remember this, I remember at one point traveling and going to a road near the border and truck after truck after truck just being lined up for miles of bringing goods into India, I mean, from India into Nepal. And this is a sign of kind of like domination, economic domination, you know, of India over Nepal in terms of its economy and Nepal being very dependent on that. And so, you know, you have a situation where you have this kind of domination. And one of the things is, you know, here, then you have this, you know, you have this crisis like this. And one of the things that somebody was pointing out is that, you know, the roads, you know, now the infrastructure of the roads and the landslides and being able to, you know, that has all kind of been shut down or in a crisis like this, you know. So, you know, it's not exactly like, you know, people are, you know, it's not as much, you know, food coming in from the countryside to the city. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of those, you know, that may be the case, but in terms of the relationship between, you know, imports into Nepal is also a big element here. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of these, you know, farmers are very small farmers, and they do sell their stuff to the cities. But, you know, this other aspect is also important to look at.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons I was raising that is because whoever it was that was making this point, they were emphasizing that actually a lot of the crops that had been harvested or the crops that were growing were destroyed as a result of the earthquake, and that this actually was setting in motion something that would be felt much more severely in the rural areas in the time to come.
Yeah, that's really, really true. I mean, in many districts, just in terms of like how the crops go, the way this worked is that the people had actually, a lot of places, people had actually just recently harvested winter grains, which means that, they were stored, you know, everything that they had harvested from the winter crop. And this all got buried by the earthquake. So now the farmers are going to have to wait until December to harvest the rainy season crops, which is the next rotation of crops. But meanwhile, there's not going to be any food for people to eat. But also, on top of that, you know, farmers have seed stock, which is being, you know, put aside for the next crop, and a lot of that was destroyed for the mid-May. You know, this was stock that was put aside for the mid-May sowing season, which is, you know, supposed to be like right now or in the next couple of weeks. So many farmers might not even be able to plant another crop and won't be able to, you know, have another crop. So, you know, there is a real threat of famine and starvation going on here.
Mm-hmm. You know,
the other thing I was going to say is that is that when you go into these villages, one thing that's very stark is that when I went there, I think this is still true, is that when you go into a lot of these villages, there's a real absence of men. A lot of these villages are just women and children. And the reason for this, a big part of the reason for this is that the farmers are very, very poor and they can't, you know, they may, you know, be able to feed their family from one crop or partially feed the family, but a lot of the sons or a lot of the husbands then leave and try to go find work. Like in the Gulf states, they try to go into the, you know, like if you go into some of these countries like Qatar or in the Arab countries where the oil fields, you'll see huge numbers of Nepalese migrant workers. And this is reflected in the countryside where a lot of these villages, that there's a lack of men. So this also comes into play now where, you know, the survivors in these villages, a lot of them, you know, there's a lack of men in these villages.
Which leads us into this next question, and I think this is extremely important. You make this point in your article. You quote someone saying that while an earthquake is a natural disaster, the consequences of these earthquakes are very much man-made. Let's talk about that.
Well, I think the thing, again, it goes back to, you know, the question of, you know, on the one hand, you know, you have like, you know, as the seismologist pointed out, you know, you have this, you know, the evidence where, you know, the same level of earthquakes hitting different places in the world, but why is there different, the casualty numbers so much different, you know? And there's a lot of different factors there. One is that you have a level of just the kind of buildings that people live in, you know? I mean, you know, in the countryside, again, you have these, you know, literally mud and thatch. You know, what's going to happen when an earthquake hits in a village where every building is like a two-story building that's just made of mud and thatch? It's going to be flattened, you know, as opposed to a concrete, steel, you know, reinforced steel concrete building, you know, that you have in L.A. or, you know, most cities and towns and even rural areas in the United States, right? Mm-hmm. And even in the cities in Kathmandu, you have a lot of these buildings that are shoddily built and, you know, even where there's codes, you know, these are, you know, not up to code and so on and so forth, right? And then so you have that level of things, you know, that is a expression of kind of like just the overall poor conditions and poverty of the country as a whole. And then you have a situation where the infrastructure is very poor. In the cities, you know, as I talked about before, but in the rural areas, you know, literally a lot of the areas that you travel in, there's no plumbing. People are living in latrines, you know, and in some areas people don't even have latrines. I mean, maybe they do now because, you know, but in some areas, actually, they didn't even have latrines. There's no clean drinking water in a lot of places. The other thing I was going to say in terms of people losing their crop, people also lost their animals. Hmm. And this is another, you know, source of food, another source of milk for people, another source of revenue for people. So this is another thing that people have lost. So, you have the ground that existed, the ground of poverty, malnourishment, inequalities, you know, all this that existed before the earthquake hit, and then you have the earthquake on top of all that. You know, so that is the man-made part. And the man-made part of that has to do with the fact that Nepal has long been a country oppressed, you know, principally oppressed and dominated by India, but also by other, you know, by imperialist countries and other foreign powers.
Mm-hmm. All right, Lee Ernesto, thank you very much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
All right. Take care. Talk to you again soon. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Lee Ernesto, journalist for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Dispatches from the People's War in Nepal. Lee has been talking with us about the recent earthquake in Nepal and getting into the fact that while the earthquake is a natural phenomenon, what happened afterwards is far from natural. In fact, it's a product of the imperialist world we live in. Well, that about wraps up yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Lynn Washington Jr., Dina Seidel, and Lee Ernesto. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today, Federico Garcia, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with something I felt was really appropriate. It's Wake Up from Funkadelic.